Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, recording in our studio at the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today we've got some major breaking news stories impacting East County, as well as some updates from around the region and the nation. Learn how the County Board of Education voted on a proposal that would split up the Grossmont Union High School District and shift some high school students into a unified Alpine District. Hear about federal funds to help homeless veterans in our region. Find out how the shooting of an unarmed black teenager in Missouri is having an impact here in San Diego, and learn why one local representative is speaking out on police militarization. Learn why workers at Food for Less stores have been picketing over the last week. Get the latest on El Cajon Council's efforts to reopen the East County Performing Arts Center, and why the city's plan to partner with a local church is drawing cheers from some and constitutional concerns from others. Hear what fire chiefs and elected officials around our region have to say about firefighting response efforts to the May wildfires, what went right, and what areas need to improve in this very special report. We'll also have a public news service report on the top national news. Plus, we'll have info on how you can apply for grant funds to improve your community. And in this centennial year for Hakumba Hot Springs, we'll replay one of our favorite episodes, taking you on a road trip to Hakumba Hot Springs, a town that is bubbling with activities. So stay tuned for all of these stories and some more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ. The County Board of Education has provided a learning experience to the Grossmont Union High School District. If you ignore the will of voters and spend off bond money slated for a new Alpine High School on other projects, there are consequences. Alpine parents have put forth a unanimous front, seeking to leave the Grossmont High School District and move their students into a new Alpine Unified School District that would be expanded or unified to add high school students. Now those parents have moved a major step closer to their goal. The San Diego County Board of Education voted on August 13th to recommend unification to the State Board of Education. The county's education board found that Alpine Parents' unification petition substantially meets all 9 criteria required by the State Education Code. Under the unification plan, a new high school in Alpine would no longer be under the control of the Grossmont Board, which defied the San Diego County Grand Jury and refused to provide a construction timetable for the long-promised Alpine High School. Voters twice supported bond measures, Prop H and Prop U, to fund building that high school. Grossmont Superintendent Ralph Swenson told the County Board Wednesday that he does not believe that a unified Alpine district will have the financial resources it would need. So to help remedy that problem, the unification proposal calls for the Grossmont District to provide a cash settlement to the Alpine District. The County and State Boards of Education will determine the amount of that settlement and should assure that the Alpine District will receive a sufficient share of Grossmont's property and assets to successfully complete unification without further burdening the Alpine School District or its taxpayers. School Services of California conducted a feasibility study and presented their independent third-party study of the unification proposal to the County Board of Education at the August 13th meeting. The board then heard testimony from backers of the unification petition, as well as from both the Alpine and the Grossmont districts. Several members of the public were also given an opportunity to comment. The only testimony against the unification proposal came from the Grossmont district itself. Everyone else who spoke testified in favor. Grossmont Board Member Priscilla Schreiber, who has stood alone against her colleagues as an unwavering supporter of building an Alpine High School, testified as an individual, and she urged the committee to support unification. She called the actions of the Grossmont Board majority, quote, deliberate, dishonest, and despicable, unquote. Schreiber faulted the board for its failure to approve building plans or make land improvements for the high school, despite the 2 bond measures totaling close to $1 billion, and for flaunting, in her words, excessive spending on other projects that voters never approved. The district purchased 98 acres of land and completed environmental impact studies. also meeting requirements of the California Environmental Quality Act. Architectural plans were submitted to the state, and site grading permits were granted. The district even used the eminent domain process to evict homeowners off the site's parcels before backing off plans to build the high school and withdrawing plans from the state architect's office. Since then, the district has contended that enrollment triggers were not met. However, substantial evidence has been submitted by other education experts indicating that those triggers were met not just once, but repeatedly. Some have speculated that the board majority's real reasons for reneging on promises to build the school are political. But others voice sheer bafflement as to why the board has acted in a seemingly punitive way toward the people of Alpine, repeatedly funding lavish projects at other schools while providing Alpine voters with absolutely nothing to show for bond monies that voters paid for. The grand jury report, which was titled Fool Me Once, Fool Me Twice, urged the Grossmont District to provide clarity to voters by either setting a clear timetable to construct the school by the end of last year or to support unification and cooperate with efforts to shift responsibility and funds for the high school to the Alpine District. Instead, the Grossmont Board majority did neither. Now, if unification occurs, the Grossmont Board's refusal to fulfill its promises and duties to voters in Alpine will have ramifications for all students in the district, since Grossmont will lose average daily attendance money for hundreds of students or more who will be shifted into the expanded Alpine District. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery. This is East County Magazine's Capital Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
Congresswoman Susan Davis has just announced that $1.2 million in federal grants will be coming to San Diego to fight homelessness among our veterans, specifically Vietnam veterans in our region. Congresswoman Davis, a San Diego Democrat whose district also includes La Mesa and El Cajon in East County, serves as the ranking member on the House Military Personnel Subcommittee. She says she has talked to many veterans living on our streets and seen their problems firsthand. It's important that they know that we have not forgotten, especially after the sacrifices they have made for our freedoms, she says. We must not rest until the thousands of homeless, including our veterans, are no longer living on San Diego's streets. Nationwide, $300 million in grants have been given out under the VA's Supportive Services, which provides services to very low-income veterans and their families who are homeless or at risk of homelessness. Funds from these grants will allow veterans and their families to get temporary financial aid on rent payments, utility payments, security deposits, and moving costs. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Leon Thompson.
City Heights residents organized a hands-up tribute late Thursday in San Diego as part of a nationwide event calling attention to the police shooting death of unarmed black teenager Michael Brown in Missouri. About 100 people gathered, wearing red ribbons on their arms. They joined hands and held a moment of silence for all victims of police violence. Witnesses have said that 18-year-old Michael Brown had tussled briefly with an officer before running away. Police say Brown pushed the officer into a car and tried to grab his weapon. The officer fired shots, and according to the witnesses, Brown first tried to flee, then turned around and put his hands in the air to surrender. But the officer kept firing, killing the young man, who had not been accused of any crime. The event sparked outrage nationwide and riots in Missouri. Police initially refused to divulge the name of the officer, citing fear for his safety. But after public pressure and media attention, the officer's name was released. Police claim that a surveillance video shows that a robbery suspect who stole cigars and roughed up a clerk at a nearby store resembles Brown. Brown's family has denounced police, claiming they're now trying to smear his name to divert attention from the shooting. The teenager had no prior arrests, and the officer was not in pursuit of a robbery suspect. Instead, he had stopped Brown for walking in the middle of the street, potentially obstructing traffic. Over the weekend, tensions escalated further in Ferguson, Missouri, where gun violence, tear gas, and police rolling out armored vehicles occurred during the first night of a controversial curfew imposed in the St. Louis suburb where the shooting occurred. The incident has raised questions over racial profiling by police, as well as the increasing militarization of police forces buying up secondhand gear and vehicles from the U.S. military, often at bargain basement prices. Here in San Diego, Police Chief Shelley Zimmerman issued a statement saying she will not tolerate racial profiling among local officers. Here's what she had to say.
Members of our community, I want to be absolutely clear. The San Diego Police Department does not and will not tolerate any racial profiling or discourteous treatment by any of our officers or employees. If you feel there is a problem, we want to know about it. There are many ways you can report any concerns that you have. Let's all work together to make sure we continue to foster the highest standards of community trust. Thank you for the privilege and opportunity to serve you.
Chief Zimmerman urged the public to report any problems with San Diego police officers to area code 619-531-2672. The San Diego police have been accused of racial profiling in traffic stops in recent months, as well as sexual assaults. Zimmerman, San Diego's new chief, has also ordered officers here to start wearing body cameras. In Rialto, California, use of body cameras by police had dramatic results. Use of force complaints fell by nearly 60% in 1 year, and complaints against officers dropped by 89%. It seems when people know they are being recorded on video, both officers and people stopped by police tend to behave better, experts have said, although the devices do raise privacy concerns. A petition calling for mandatory use of body cameras by police nationwide has been posted on the website for the White House, and so far it has drawn over 500,000 signatures. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
The shooting of Michael Brown, an unarmed black teenager in Missouri, and the riots that followed have drawn national attention to the militarization of the local police departments across America. As the United States war in Afghanistan and Iraq have wound down, the Pentagon has disposed of much of its military weaponry and armored vehicles by selling them to community law enforcement agencies. The agencies sometimes pay just a few thousand dollars for items that originally cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. This includes many local agencies. La Mesa Police, for instance, recently purchased an armored vehicle for responding to SWAT-type incidents. But now voices on both sides of the political aisle are speaking out and raising concerns that such police militarization may foster mistrust in the community, potentially making violent clashes more likely than when police can look community members in the eye and interact in less confrontational and frightening manners. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder has this to say. At a time when we must be seeking to rebuild trust between law enforcement and the local community, I am deeply concerned that the deployment of military equipment and vehicles sends a conflicting message. Holder added that the Justice Department could coordinate with local authorities to discuss how police officers could maintain public safety without relying on unnecessarily extreme displays of force, Politico reported. Politico also quotes Congressman Duncan Hunter, a Republican who represents San Diego and East County communities. Hunter later posted his quote on his Facebook page. He states, "The idea that state and local police departments need tactical vehicles and MRAPs with gun turrets is excessive. Certain resources are designed and manufactured for a military mission, and it should stay that way. Radios, personal protection equipment is one thing, and makes sense from a taxpayer's perspective. I'm not comfortable with the idea that equipment designated for the battlefield could have a community application." Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Leon Thompson.
If you shopped at Food for Less in the past week or so, you likely encountered picketers. The United Food and Commercial Workers Union, which represents grocery store employees at most of the grocery stores in San Diego, have renewed their contract with major grocery store chain owners, except Food for Less. The chain has about a dozen stores countywide, including East County locations in El Cajon, Lemon Grove, and Santee. The workers have not called a strike, but they have been holding informational picketing to educate the public and ask the public to support their efforts by avoiding shopping at Food for Less, for now. According to a flyer from the union, Food for Less has proposed to cut hours, transfer higher-paid work to lower-paid employees, pay a smaller share into the workers' health and welfare fund, and has rejected the union's previous agreement to provide new employees wage rates above the minimum wage. Food for Less is owned by Kroger, which also owns Ralph's, one of the largest and most profitable grocery store companies in the U.S. Just last month, Kroger announced that it made over $500 million in profits just in the first quarter of 2014. East County Magazine contacted Kroger's for comment, but the company did not respond. The chain is highly successful, yet Food for Less workers, who are mostly Latino and serve customers in the Latino community, earn less than their counterparts at Ralph's, which is also owned by Kroger. Food for Less is a no-frills grocery store where the customers bag their own groceries at the checkout. The question is, should workers at Food for Less be paid less than the workers doing the same exact work at Ralph's and other grocery stores? Lourdes Ceja has worked at Food for Less for 17 years. She says, Food for Less is part of a huge, profitable corporation that refuses to pay its workers fairly. Food for Less insists on providing us fewer hours of work, contributing less to our health care, and generally making it more difficult for us to make ends meet. We need your help to get a fair deal that helps support our families, she asks. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Raina Menashe.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
Next up, Nadine Abbott reports from El Cajon on why a vote by the El Cajon City Council to move forward on partnering with the Rock Church to reopen the East County Performing Arts Center is dividing community members.
The El Cajon City Council voted on Monday to enter into exclusive negotiations with the Rock Church to rent the East County Performing Arts Center for their use. Staff described the contract as follows.
They're proposing to use the facility approximately 130 days per year. They're proposing an annual rent to the city of $216,000, which based on 132 days would work out to a little over $1,600 a day rental fee. They're proposing a five-year option with 2% annual rent increases. They are proposing also something which has been discussed with different entities in the past, but not for a while. So this is a bit unique to the Rock proposal, to use the approximately 13,000 square foot of land between the Rock, between Ekback and Main Street, which is currently landscaped, has some trees on there, as a building site for the purposes of constructing a two-story, 20,000 square foot building. As a part of that proposal, all construction and maintenance would be the Rock's responsibility. They would use the building for their own purposes. They would pay $4,000 a month, triple net, which is $48,000 a year to the city as a part of the land lease. It would be a proposed 35-year land lease, at which point the city would take ownership of the building at no cost. It would include, very important, a rooftop venue facility, an entertainment or event facility that the city could either use itself or rent out to city community users around El Cajon in the East County, unlimited number of times. The building itself would need to include a catering quality kitchen and also a VIP reception room for city use, and that reception room could also be used on an as-needed basis for ECPAC. Looking at this rather...
It is a very popular proposition, and Mayor Bill Wells considers this a win-win for the city. Among those speaking in favor was Kathy Seaman of the El Cajon Downtown Business Partners, who said...
My name is Kathy Zeman. I am on the board of directors for the El Cajon Downtown Business Partners, who is the PBID entity in El Cajon. And Daryl Priest wanted to be here today. He's very ill and was unable to come, so I'm speaking on behalf of our organization. I have to apologize. We actually had a lot of people set to come to this tonight. We did not. We got the time of the meeting wrong, so we were going to have quite a few people here. But going on here. So from the perspective of the Downtown El Cajon Business Partners, this proposed plan dovetails really nicely with our goals and objectives. Our objectives are to help businesses be retained in El Cajon, to recruit businesses into El Cajon, and to bring as many people into El Cajon as we can on a weekly basis. And as Jonathan mentioned, we do this by our Wednesday Cajon Classic Cruises and our Friday night concert series. And this runs from April through October. So we kind of rely on building up a lot of goodwill and get people into the habit of coming into El Cajon April through October, and hope that that's going to carry on throughout the end of the year, throughout the rest of the year. The beauty of this proposal is that it's a continuous supply of potential clients and customers throughout the entire year. And I think it's going to help with a lot of businesses that maybe have ebb and flows in their businesses. This is going to keep a constant flow of potential customers for them. The reopening of EPCAC has been a highly anticipated event. Whenever somebody finds out I'm involved with the PEEP, it is the number one question that I get asked is, when is EPCAC going to open again? And I think that kudos should go to everyone on the council and on the city staff for coming up with such a fiscally responsible way to achieve that goal. And again, EPCAC is going to bring people in from all over the county that might not necessarily come to El Cajon. The other thing that I see happening is that people are going to be coming to El Cajon week after week after week, and they're going to look around El Cajon, and they're going to see what a great place El Cajon is, and they're going to say, you know, El Cajon's got it going on, and El Cajon is a really business-friendly environment, and I want to open my business in El Cajon, or I want to move my business to El Cajon. And I see a lot of businesses popping up and, you know, helping grow El Cajon. So this proposal is a winner any way you look at it. It's going to create jobs, it's going to bring thousands of people into El Cajon, and it's going to reopen EPCAC. So from the perspective of the downtown El Cajon business partners, I think that this proposal is not only a continuation, but a real boost to the economic growth and development that's already happening here in El Cajon. Thanks.
Thank you.
The majority of those present were in favor of it, but there were those opposed to it. Ray Lotz told East County Magazine that
church-state integration issue that, you know, the Constitution and the various court cases that have come after that make it pretty clear that the government that we have here cannot be biased about what church organizations they help out. Here they're helping out a specific religion by giving them a sweetheart deal on this theater versus other religions. Now, they said they went out and asked other people to come in and offer to run the theater. But really, this was just a ploy to make it look like they're doing the right thing. They didn't look for any management organizations to actually manage the theater the way it should be. And we think this is the big defect. Instead of going for the secular approach, they went only for the churches. You know, like, which churches want it? And instead of saying, well, how can we manage this in a way for everybody?
And Bonnie Price spoke in a similar vein this way.
The primary issue is the separation of church and state. The way this proposal seems to be moving is that the El Cajon City Council is going to be renting a facility under market value to a church, and then they're going to be constructing a building on public property, and the church and the city both are going to be using the building. And this seems like an undue entanglement, and I know that there have been Supreme Court cases decided on that issue.
This is Nadine Abbott for KNSJ Radio and East County Magazine.
This is Miriam Raftery with a report on one of the hottest issues in the San Diego region. We're now in our third year of drought, and many fire officials warn that this could be the worst wildfire season ever. So just how prepared is our region for the next major firestorm? Following the May wildfires that caused a countywide disaster declaration here, fire chiefs and elected officials from across the San Diego region met to assess what went right and some areas where there's room for improvement. Supervisor Diane Jacob chaired that meeting. She opened by reminding those present that the county shared a Grand Golden Watchdog Award from the San Diego Taxpayers Association, along with the city and the Navy, for their mutual response to those fires, which scorched over 29,000 acres in both unincorporated areas and several North County cities. Since the 2003 Cedar Fire scorched our region, Supervisor Jacobs says that many improvements have been made and the county has formed a county fire authority. She observes, "We've come a long way, but we'd all like to be better prepared." And then she asked what's needed to better protect us in the future. Tony Meacham is the new fire chief for CAL FIRE's San Diego Division. He noted that responses to such catastrophic conditions require regional cooperation among multiple fire departments and agencies. Now, the county has purchased lots of equipment in recent years, including fire trucks, water tenders, rescue and support gear. Ron Lane, the county's department chief administrative officer, called the county's air fleet probably the highest of any county in the U.S. He adds that San Diego has 10 aircraft available for an initial attack locally, including aircraft from the U.S. Forest Service, CAL FIRE, the county, city, and SDG&E. In addition, about 30 extended attack support aircraft are available from the U.S. Navy and Marines in the first agreement of its kind nationally, but those are subject to U.S. Defense Department needs. A regional communication system has also been upgraded, both internally as well as the Alert San Diego system that can now reach 950,000 homes and businesses, plus many cell phones and web users. Fire chiefs and elected officials from across the region then spoke out on the issues they want to see resolved. Oceanside's mayor, Jim Wood, cited a critical gap. He said there were no air assets in his area during the early hours. "We had one helicopter when Carlsbad was burning down," he told the group. "There was not enough water." He said he made many calls trying to get more resources during the fires, including to Governor Jerry Brown, who insisted that our region has plenty of air support, Mayor Wood said. So he asked, "Where are they?" Mayor Wood said he believes a fire in Oceanside could have been knocked down early if there had been air support. He added that as the San Marcos and Escondido fires grew large, he only saw two helicopters and no larger aircraft. He also called Camp Pendleton, but says he was told they couldn't release air assets without CAL FIRE approval, even though buildings were burning down in Carlsbad and Oceanside at that time. The mayor also sees a need for aircraft with night vision capacity after dark. A CAL FIRE spokesman said there were 15 helicopters fighting the Cocos fire at one point, and he noted that Camp Pendleton had threats to base housing and critical infrastructure that may have prevented it from sending aircraft. But Mayor Wood fired back, "I could tell from the conversation that they would have responded, but they had to have CAL FIRE approval." Supervisor Jacobs said these were excellent points, and she promised to follow up. A San Marcos fire chief said that by the time the fire there began, the last of the major fires to break out, the aircraft situation had improved quite a bit due to mutual aid. "I don't think we could have fit another aircraft," he said. A CAL FIRE representative explained that their goal is to have an aircraft over any incident in no more than 20 minutes. He says 90% of fires under CAL FIRE command are limited to 10 acres or less, and that CAL FIRE is effective in most situations. But the May wildfires, all 19 of them, were far from a normal situation. Chief Don Butts with Viejas Fire Department here in East County listed another concern. He said, "We're missing something in the county. We need the ability for night flying, including night hoist rescues." But a county representative insisted that this was not needed, as in recent months the only night rescues needed were lost hikers, not serious injuries. Chief Butts also asked that fire chiefs be given the authority to order brush cleared up 100 feet from homes or 30 feet from roads. Another chief called for funding for enforcement of codes, citing a community with only one road in and one road out where brush clearance hasn't been done. Supervisor Jacob asked to see a list of county roads that need brush management. Tim Geiser, who's president of the Deer Springs Fire Protection District in North County, cited Deer Springs near Escondido as a bad example of planning. He says, "We need to be sure before these communities are ever put in place that we can get people out of them." A fire official from San Diego said city helicopters are often called out to the county for rescue missions. The county should be providing those operations, he said, adding that there aren't enough aircraft with night flying capabilities, voicing a common theme. He also wants to see the county provide air paramedic services instead of relying on other agencies for this. But a county representative dismissed this concern as well, saying that the county also provides mutual aid to the city. Although there was a lot of discussion about equipment, One glaring problem not discussed at this meeting was the many dark days and station closures we've seen in rural East County. These station closures are due to volunteers who are trained and receive small stipends, being hired away by other fire agencies, including CAL FIRE, faster than the county can train them. Although countywide response times averaged 10.5 minutes last year in the unincorporated areas, some communities in East County have had far longer waits for emergency responders to arrive, even for routine house fires and medical emergencies, let alone wildfires. The chiefs did discuss a need to increase surge capacity of fire engines to respond in major fires, as well as a need for further improving communications and brush clearing. Sheriff Bill Gore said the county now contracts with the state, paying them to take prisoners who can work cutting fire breaks. And Sheriff Gore adds, "We can do better, and we want more of them." Chief Butts noted that there are still old fire camps at Campo and McCain Valley sitting basically vacant, and he suggested these could be used as camps for brush-clearing crews. A representative from Lakeside Fire said Lakeside and Santee have effective mutual aid agreements and that other agencies should do the same. A Lakeside Fire representative also revealed that during a mobile home park in Lakeside, the sheriff evacuated the area but didn't let the chiefs know. People were coming up and asking, "Where's Grandma?" he recalled, citing a need for a coordinated communication center. There was also a discussion about the media. Some voiced concerns that with the internet, many bloggers are now calling themselves media, and that's a double-edged sword. On one hand, social media can spread news during disaster like, well, like wildfire, and on the other hand, it's important for that information to be accurate. Supervisor Jacob called for all agencies to coordinate communications so that they're sending out the same information. She wants to see information centralized. But an Encinitas official said that in his area, a local school got information out faster to parents than the city or anybody else. He suggests that every entity, schools, cities, fire departments, and various agencies, should each have their own communications people to get word out fast when needed. Mr. Lane, speaking for the county, concluded, "Media is a partner to us. We are doubling down to make sure we know how to communicate." This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation. The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
This is Miriam Raftery back with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ. And now we're going to hear from Public News Service with some headlines from around the nation.
Welcome to the Public News Service update. I'm Mike Clifford. Among the stories on our nationwide rundown, new information released in the police shooting of a black Missouri teenager appears to reignite unrest. Polls show some voters looking for support of caregivers in the November elections, and a warning that parents and young athletes taking one for the team can result in lifelong problems. Now our top story, blocking the street. The New York Times quotes the Ferguson, Missouri police chief as saying that was the reason Darren Wilson, a white officer with 4 years on the force, stopped Michael Brown. The department had waited almost a week to disclose the identity of the officer who shot and killed the 18-year-old unarmed teen. President Obama this week took the extraordinary action of asking the Justice Department to investigate.
He was 18 years old. His family will never hold Michael in their arms again. And when something like this happens, The local authorities, including the police, have a responsibility to be open and transparent about how they are investigating that death and how they are protecting the people in their communities.
Protesters took to the streets again Friday night after local police released a surveillance video of the teen in what appears to be the act of stealing cigars from a convenience store. They offered no new details of the alleged altercation they say led to the police shooting. The November general election is now less than 3 months away. A new poll shows older folks in Iowa are seeking candidates who will focus on improving their economic security. More on that from John Michelson.
Nancy Lamond with AARP says their survey questioned likely voters in Iowa age 50 and up and found that due to the high cost of living, especially with health care and taxes, many have or are planning to postpone retirement.
For too many older Americans, their income isn't keeping up with their daily cost of living, and that's for older workers and retirees.
Lamond says caregiving is also a vital issue this election for older Iowans who want to stay in and receive care in their homes, allowing them to live independently as they age. John Michelson reporting.
Texas Governor Rick Perry indicted by a state grand jury Friday. Political reports, Perry backers are calling it a witch hunt. Perry charged with abuse of official capacity, a felony in the Lone Star State, with a possible sentence of 5 to 99 years in prison. The death of Robin Williams this week by suicide may serve as a powerful and tragic reminder that mental illness does not discriminate. Troy Wild reports on the impact in Arizona.
Steve Skiro is the chairman of the Arizona chapter of the American Foundation for the Prevention of Suicide. He says Robin Williams' death highlights the secrecy and stigma that still accompany mental illness.
I think until we begin to look at it that way and to treat both the physical and mental aspects as part of health in general, I think we continue to have a problem with fighting mental illness.
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, suicide is the 10th leading cause of death for Americans, with nearly 40,000 reported cases each year. Police say Robin Williams ended his life at his home in Northern California on Monday following an intense battle with depression in recent weeks. He was 63. I'm Troy Wild.
The CDC estimates someone in America dies from suicide almost every 14 minutes. Kentucky has laws requiring immunization for children in child care and in school, but that doesn't mean the state achieves full participation. In fact, Greg Steinlmeyer tells us the immunization rate dropped in 2012. That's the most recent year where data is available.
Kentucky's Deputy Commissioner for Public Health, Dr. Craig Humbaugh, calls reducing outbreaks of vaccine-preventable diseases one of the greatest success stories of the 20th century. In his view, as the world gets smaller, the reasons for vaccinating kids get bigger.
We live in a global economy where there are links every day to other parts of the world. And there are parts of the world that still have these childhood diseases circulating on a regular basis.
I'm Greg Stottlemyre reporting.
And finally, young athletes taking to the field, track and turf in Indiana as fall sports are getting underway. Mary Sherman has been looking into a new survey. It finds a growing number will likely face an injury during the season.
According to the research from Safe Kids Worldwide, an alarming number of young people are injured as a result of aggressive play, hiding injuries to stay in the game, and parents who pressure coaches to keep them on the field. Safe Kids President and CEO Kate Carr says parents, coaches, and players should have their own huddle before the season and set some ground rules to prevent injuries.
You can discuss dirty play, hard fouls, how you're going to deal with them. You can discuss the training of a coach. You can discuss parental behavior on the sidelines. You can talk to athletes about the importance of speaking up.
A law that went into effect this year in Indiana requires concussion awareness training for high school and youth football coaches. It also imposes a 24-hour waiting period on young players who are suspected of suffering a concussion. It's estimated that nationally, 3,400 children seek medical treatment every day for sports injuries. Carr says more than half of athletes reported playing while injured, and more than half of coaches said they felt pressured to put injured players back in the game. She says this behavior just leads to bigger problems down the road.
The injury that you play with could be compounded in that game or in that practice. A lot of injuries happen during practice, and that could result in a lifetime of a more serious challenge that you have to face physically rather than missing a single game.
Carr adds that proper technique, strength training, and stretching all can help prevent injuries. She encourages young athletes to only participate in one sport at a time to prevent overuse injuries. Mary will be back with our Monday edition. For now, this is Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
Want to help improve your neighborhood over the next 5 years? Depending on need, federal money may be available for your community. Thanks to public involvement and federal community development block grants, or CDBG funds, improvements have been made to local youth and senior centers, parks, streets, drainage systems, and fire facilities. If you know where CDBG funds should be spent and you live in the unincorporated area, the County Department of Housing and Community Development, HCD, will tell you how local organizations can apply for funds during several public meetings. HCD will host meetings in Ramona and Fallbrook on September 23rd and in Lincoln Acres and Spring Valley on September 25th. In addition, a special meeting in San Diego on September 24th is devoted to discussing future priority needs in the unincorporated area and the cities of Coronado, Del Mar, Imperial Beach, Lemon Grove, Poway, and Solana Beach. CDBG funds may be available to nonprofits for use in lower-income communities in the unincorporated areas. Nonprofits that apply for funding must show a public benefit and align with the County Board of Supervisors' strategic priorities. The deadline to submit proposals for CDBG funding is October 24th. Can't attend a meeting? You can fill out a community needs survey online. The upcoming meetings will also provide information on other programs that fund affordable housing, facilities for the homeless and those at risk, and affordable housing for low-income people with HIV or AIDS. Additional information and applications are available on HCD's webpage at sdhcd.com. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Ed Barrena.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
Next up, we're going to play an oldie but goodie, our On the Road to Hacumba Hot Springs. This was originally recorded last year, and we do have a couple of updates since it ran. The Hacumba Spa is now reopened, and the centennial celebrations are well underway.
We're on the road in East County, visiting some amazing towns and meeting some incredible people across our region. Welcome to another adventure on East County Magazine's On the Road.
This is Miriam Raftery. This week, we're on the road in Hacumba Hot Springs, a town that is bubbling with activity. The town recently changed its name to take back its historic roots. The name Hacumba means healing waters and traces its roots back to the Kumeyaay Native American people who used to spend their winters by these natural hot springs. By the 1920s, Hacumba had become a mecca for Hollywood celebrities in the silent movie era. But then a fire burned down the historic hotel and bathhouse, and construction of Interstate 8 moved traffic away from old Highway 80 through the heart of this community. Hacumba almost became a ghost town, but now it is springing back to life thanks to the vision of the people here with us today. Dave Landman is a successful businessman who was actually asked by the townspeople to buy a rundown spa and resort and turn it once again into a destination to draw people to Hacumba Hot Springs. So he bought the promissory note for the Hacumba Hot Springs Resort, and he made a surprising discovery. Dave, tell us what else was in that note.
Well, it turns out that the promissory note was secured by 29 properties throughout the town. It included most of the downtown area, some residential sites, and a lot of vacant land.
So what was your reaction when you learned that you were the proud new owner of an entire town?
Well, it went from one project to 29 projects, so it was a little bit overwhelming at the time.
Now, the people of the town were confident that Dave could make this a success because he already owns another wildly successful business in Hacumba. Tell us about that, Dave.
Yeah, about 15 years ago, my wife and I bought a rundown RV park on the north side of Interstate 8, and we actually turned it into the eighth largest clothing optional resort in the United States, the Anza Springs Resort.
So what is so attractive about Hacumba to bring so many people there?
It's a number of things. Number one, it's just an hour away from San Diego. So, you know, we call that the daycation destination place where people can come out for the weekend or just for the day use and enjoy the facilities. There's also the climate is beautiful because we're above the clouds, and in the summertime especially, we're so much cooler than the valley. So we get a lot of people up there from the El Centro, Yuma, Palm Springs area.
Now, Dave has been hard at work remodeling the Hukumba Hot Springs Resort, adding a new restaurant and a Southwest decor. But there won't be any skinny dipping since the spa will not be clothing optional. You can find out more about their big opening season plans at the www.hukumbaresort.com. Now, Dave, what else are you planning in the area?
Nothing is finalized yet, but we've had a number of calls from people interested in renting some of the retail spaces. We've had some artists contact us because they know our desire to turn it into an art-type community. We're working on a number of things. You know, some of the things in the back of my head are maybe a winery. We've talked about a number of other things, but that one kind of comes to the head all the time.
Thank you very much, Dave. Danielle Cook is a driving force behind the Hukumba Boulevard Revitalization Alliance. In fact, she and her husband, Howard, helped recruit Dave to buy the Hot Springs Resort. Danielle, tell us about your vision for Hukumba Hot Springs.
My vision of Hukumba Hot Springs is similar to that of the Landmans. I envision the community as being another backcountry version, if you will, of Taos, New Mexico, a community where artists gather, where entrepreneurs want to come in and build businesses, where people want to come and chill out at the Hot Springs Spa and enjoy our special air, light, and ambiance.
You've started some websites where people can find out more about the hidden treasures in Hukumba Hot Springs and the surrounding areas.
Yes, we started a website about a year ago, www.gosandiegobackcountry.org, to give tourists an idea of some of the free things that they could do in the backcountry, in Boulevard and Hukumba, and also places where they could stay, places where they could eat. We even have a section that tells people of different hikes they can go on and gives them an idea of a road trip that they can take with their family.
And you also have another website devoted just to Hukumba, and that site is hukumba.org.
Yes.
Now, there is also a lake, Lake Hukumba, which had gone virtually dry, and now I understand it's being restored.
Hukumba Lake now is for a virtual birder's paradise. The lake is filling up naturally. We have nesting tricolors, which are a bird of special interest, according to the Audubon. We have birders there every weekend, and this has brought in business for Hukumba Lounge and will bring in business for the spa. In addition, some of the residents of Hukumba have taken it upon themselves to clear brush and have built trails, so you can now walk almost entirely around the lake.
Wow, that's great. Now, the Hukumba Lounge is a new Wi-Fi cafe and coffee house that opened up recently. Plus, as you mentioned, the Hukumba Hikers and Walkers is another new group that's formed, and they're leading people on treks all over through the scenic mountains, deserts, and historic sites in this region. Hukumba also has an arts council, and recently they revived another town tradition, the Hukumba Blues Festival.
Enigmatic love. A love like no other. Ooh-hoo. In the summer sun, I strolled the shore. The sand warmed my feet. The waves soothed my heart within a glowing light.
I'm here today with Joe Marshall, a talented blues musician who is the powerhouse behind the festival. Joe, tell me how long you've been playing the blues.
Well, I've been playing the blues for about 45 years, and I got interested in the blues. Some friends of mine started turning me on to it. At the time, I was interested in most rock and roll, I guess about anybody my age would have been. And I found that the blues suited more of my music, because I primarily play the harmonica. I love the blues because it's for everybody. It's from the working man to the white collar.
This is the second annual Hukumba Blues Festival. What makes this such a special event for the local musicians?
It's a great event for the local musicians. They get to network. They get to meet a lot of other musicians from all over. We had musicians from San Diego. We had musicians from Imperial Valley. We had musicians from the Midwest. We had musicians from Northern California. And so it made it very special. Primarily because of that, and secondly because it gave all these people a chance to reunite.
So it's one big jam session out there.
One big family, one big jam session, yes.
We're going to end today by playing a little riff here from Mama Christie, who is one of the talented musicians that you could hear out at the Hukumba Blues Festival. And you can find her music at www.mamachristie.com. This song is called Drip, and it was written after the 9/11 attacks, and it's all about the healing power of love. And here in the town of Healing Waters, Hakumba Hot Springs, it seems especially fitting. You can find out more about Hakumba Hot Springs at www.eastcountymagazine.org, and be sure to tune in for future editions of On the Road in East County.
Oftentimes, the issue of hunger is associated with people in inner cities where the cost of living tends to be high. But a new study shows that some of the greatest need can be found where America's food supply is grown and raised. John Bailey with the Center for Rural Affairs authored the report, which examines the use of food stamps, now called SNAP benefits, from 2008 to 2012.
And what we found is that during that time period, more households in rural areas receive SNAP benefits than did households in the more urban, both metropolitan and small city areas.
During the years reviewed, more than 14% of rural households received SNAP benefits, compared to slightly under 11% of urban households. Another key finding, says Bailey, is that rural areas and small cities have higher percentages of households with seniors and children receiving food support than in large urban areas.
SNAP is providing a way for those people in those households to meet their food needs, which is important because those two population groups are probably most at risk of hunger and food insecurity.
In rural areas, one in nine households has a SNAP recipient who is either under the age of 18 or an adult 60 years of age or older. For Public News Service, I'm John Michelson.
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities. This is Gray Feathers with a Tribal Beat report. The Hamul Action Committee, or JAC, a community group opposed to the casino at Hamul Indian Village, has filed yet another lawsuit. However, the three-story, $360 million Hollywood casino that the Hamul tribe plans to build has already broken ground and is slated to open in 2015. The latest legal action filed August 16th seeks to invalidate a two-acre easement for soil nails at the Rancho Hamul Ecological Preserve just south of the excavation. Soil nails are a construction method to stabilize hillside slopes subject to rock slides or erosion. Area residents say they've documented damage done by the soil nails with photos taken by a drone. JAC claims the nail holes extend several feet and will be filled with concrete, an action they claim violates the California Environmental Quality Act. The suit seeks to invalidate an easement. Fish and wildlife attorneys counter that because the nails are underground, this will not impact the environment on this federally owned public land. The residents groups has two additional suits pending. One is against Caltrans and San Diego County over traffic issues. The next hearing in this case will be on August 22nd. The other lawsuit filed by JAC and Hamul Community Church is against the U.S. Bureau of Indian Affairs, U.S. Department of Interior, and National Indian Gaming Commission. This suit claims the lands are not eligible for gaming because the site was improperly designated as a reservation. The tribe has sought to have the case dismissed, but a judge has granted plaintiffs the right to file an amended complaint by August 26th. The tribe faces an additional lawsuit filed by Walter Rosales and Karen Toggery, who formerly lived on the reservation. They contend the construction at the casino site desecrated their family remains. A judge ruled against Rosales and Toggery, who have said they plan to file an appeal. The tribe maintains that the project is needed to lift tribal members out of poverty. The Jamul Indians have made significant design changes in efforts to accommodate community concerns, such as reducing height by 58% from the original proposal, as well as reducing water use by 58% and making other changes. Upon completion, the casino will bring an estimated 2,500 jobs to the Jamul area, according to the tribe's website, while the exterior will feature earth tones designed to complement the environment, the interior will reflect elements of classic Hollywood. The JAC, however, has repeatedly stated that it does not believe mitigation can adequately address community impacts and that the group will continue seeking to block the casino project in any form.
This is Miriam Raftery with a story that should be music to the ears of aspiring music students at San Diego State University. SDSU is launching a new program aimed at empowering music students to run their own successful businesses. Open to students in all music disciplines, from classical voice to jazz and composition, the Music Entrepreneurship and Business Program is a professional Bachelor of Music degree with a specialization in entrepreneurship. An article by Beth Downing Chi, posted SDSU's News Center, reports that the program is a partnership between the College of Business Administration and the College of Professional Studies and Fine Arts. Associate Dean Donna Connedy says students need help in today's highly competitive environment and that the new program will provide them with confidence and skills to be successful entrepreneurs. While other colleges around the nation offer programs geared to help musicians in commercial music fields gain entrepreneurship skills, SDSU is believed to be the first university in the nation open to any artistically qualified student. If successful, the program could become a model for other departments on campus, such as design, theater, and film, to boost career opportunities for creative students through similar entrepreneurship programs.
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road.
We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment.
If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.